So if you take kind of the broad perspective, what we've been doing is, for most of our time, is figuring out how to calculate electric fields and voltages given charge distributions or boundary conditions. And the main take-home lesson from that, I think, is that R prime points at the source and R points at where we're trying to observe the electric field or the voltage, and R minus R prime points from the source to the point where we're trying to observe. And that'll all come back to haunt us when we do the same thing again with magnetic fields, right? So soon we'll be dealing with currents as the source of magnetic fields, and it's all going to be the same, except now made more complicated by having cross products every place. So we took kind of a break from that to talk about kind of the why of this, as opposed to the kind of straightforward mathematics. And you might kind of wonder how physics is divided up, because it doesn't seem very divided at the undergraduate level. So people are plasma physicists or astrophysicists or atomic physicists. They're applying the stuff you've learned to lots of different situations. And kind of the stuff that we were doing in this chapter would fall under the name of condensed matter physics if we want to include liquids, or solid state physics. So we're trying to figure out how these materials work on an atomic basis. And kind of the starting point was to realize the surprising fact that this electric field we've been calculating, which certainly is hiding a lot of complexity, is not the same thing as what the electric field feels by an atom. So to get a handle on that, what we said is that the atomic field felt by an atom, we can calculate by taking out a sphere that surrounds that atom that we treated as if it was made out of continuous stuff. We know what sort of electric field this sphere makes because we calculated explicitly. It makes this minus P over 3 epsilon naught sort of electric field. And then we can treat as atoms all of the atoms that are in that sphere. So we take away and we put back, and we should end up getting the electric field that the individual atom feels. And then we kind of cheat and we say, well, in lots of circumstances, the electric field due to all of the neighboring particles is going to be zero. And it's kind of a worrisome statement, because why don't I make that sphere encompass everything? And then there's nothing there, right? So there is a little bit of trickery involved in this, but maybe not a whole lot. Certainly, this is going to make sense for cases where the atoms are randomly arranged, like in liquids or gases. We can show that the sum of the dipoles caused in that from a cubic lattice is also zero. But for a generic sort of crystal, the sum of those atomic dipoles is not going to be zero at a particular lattice site. So there would be more work to be done. But in any case, in the simple cases of gases and liquids, we expect that this sum is going to be zero. And then with a little bit of work, we were able to relate macroscopic quantities that we could measure with something the size of a capacitor, and atomic properties, that is to say how much an atom will become a point dipole if we put it in an electric field. That was this atomic polarizability. And then we made a very simple model that we shouldn't really believe to any high degree of accuracy, that the atomic polarizability was proportional to the volume of an atom. And this constant 3 that it's in front of that in real life turned out to be a pi or a 2, you wouldn't have any reason to complain. The model's not supposed to be that accurate. If it was 30 or 0.3, maybe we would start to figure out that something different is going on in those sorts of circumstances. So with that sort of consideration, we talked about the volume of a atom times the number of atoms per volume. That's kind of the fraction of space that is filled with atoms. And it turns out that has that sort of behavior. So for solids where a fair fraction of the volume is filled by atom, we expect that K is going to be substantially different from 1. And that is indeed the case. For most any solid, K is going to be 2, 3, 4, 5. as we've said lots of times, water is really unusual in that it has a dielectric constant of something like 80. Okay, so this model was a model where we were thinking about the dipole coming about because the atom was stretched, the nucleus moving one way, the electron cloud moving the other way. There are also molecules that come with their own dipole, like water, where the oxygen is grabbing some of the negative charge, leaving behind positive charge. So we end up with point dipoles. And in an electric field, we've shown that a point dipole has this energy. And we expect things generally to be in the low energy state. So if the electric field was in this direction and the dipole was like that, there's a torque that will twist that dipole so it aligns with the electric field. And what we said is that at finite temperature, there's going to be disruption to this process. And you all haven't taken the course in statistical mechanics yet, so it's maybe hard to convince you of that. I tried a couple of ways. So one way was by the Boltzmann factor that we talked about in 370. The Boltzmann factor, roughly speaking, gives you the probability that a particular state is going to be present. And the E here is the energy and T is the temperature. So if we're near absolute zero, small changes in temperatures are going to make big changes in this probability. And in particular, at low temperature, we're going to expect things to be in the lowest available energy state, because just to go up a little bit of energy is going to change that probability dramatically. On the other hand, at high temperature, kind of doesn't matter what the energy is, right? This is going to be e to the zero for any state if we have temperatures that are actually infinite. So at high temperatures, we expect kind of equal democracy, every state being equally populated. At low temperatures, we expect things to be in the ground state, the lowest available state. So in terms of these dipoles, at low temperature, we expect they'll all be aligned with the electric field. At high temperature, it kind of doesn't matter where they are. They don't care where they are. And on average, they'll be pointing in no particular direction.
What's approximately the Boltzmann constant
then? A little bit louder?
The Boltzmann constant, like approximately what's the number for?
So the Boltzmann constant at room, so KT, which is really what you care, okay. So first
yeah,
of all,
yeah, that's what I'm
asking. So KT is a unit of energy, right? So the answer is going to be an energy that I'm going to give you. And it's going to be an energy that starts to be significant at room temperature. And it's about a 40th of an electron volt. So for typical atomic processes, like the states in the hydrogen atom, you know that those energies are more than an electron volt. So it's very likely that a hydrogen is going to be in the ground state at any particular time. So if we get to temperatures that are 40 times room temperature, thousands of degrees hot, then maybe you're going to find some of the time the hydrogen is going to be in its excited state. Okay, so a different way of looking at it that probably only means stuff to Kyle, but will soon mean stuff to people who are taking thermo.
Next week
you see delta G's.
That's right.
So if we have an array of dipoles that are randomly oriented, there's a huge amount of entropy. You remember that entropy has to do with this order. If we go to an ordered state, then there's going to be a huge change in entropy. And that change in entropy is going to be particularly valuable if the temperature is high. Right, so this thing here tells us that at high temperatures, disorder is going to be highly favored. At low temperatures, who cares what the entropy is? This term is effectively not there, and we're going to be at delta H is basically the energy, and so we're going to be in the state that has the lowest possible energy. So, I don't know, for those that don't know, delta G is the Gibbs energy, and in order for a process to occur, delta G has to be negative. Things only go downhill. Delta H, technically speaking, is the enthalpy, but close enough, it's the internal energy of the system. And T is, of course, temperature, and delta S is the change in entropy. Okay, so that's just a feeling. So roughly speaking, you should expect that at low temperatures, things are going to be in the ground state, and at high temperatures, they're going to be in the excited state. And it just turns out, for normal size electric fields and normal size temperatures, we're in this region where things basically are almost evenly distributed. The net polarization is basically zero. So in this region, there's going to be a roughly linear proportionality between the applied electric field and the corresponding average component of the dipole. And that relationship is given by here. At low temperatures or at big electric fields, we will get all of these guys in the low energy state, all pointing in the direction of the electric field. And we also had some vocabulary words. This sort of phenomena is much more important for magnetic properties than for electric properties. At least that's where it was all studied first. But it all is basically the same. Just as there are electric dipoles, there are magnetic dipoles, and they want to line up with a magnetic field just like electric dipoles want to line up with electric fields. Things that are permanent magnets are said to be ferromagnetics. All of their dipoles are nicely aligned with each other to produce a polarized material. Hysteresis is a big word that means things depend on the history. And in particular, if you try and get all the dipoles arranged by putting on a big electric field, they will tend to stick in that direction. So when you remove the electric field, they won't all go back to zero for a ferroelectric material. Curie temperature, it turns out all of this depends on temperature. If we're at high enough temperature, materials that are permanent magnets will lose that ability, and their atomic dipoles will all be pointed in random directions again. And that happens suddenly the way ice melts. It doesn't happen kind of gradually. Okay, so ferroelectrics are things that have a fixed dipole moment per unit volume. The equivalent thing of water, where they get aligned when there's an electric field and the temperature is sufficiently low, those are called paramagnetic materials. Hysteresis, things depend on history. Curie temperature, at high enough temperatures, these magnetic properties, electric or magnetic properties disappear. Questions about any of that? Okay, so we were starting out talking about how to calculate electric fields and voltages based on charges. And we took this break talking about some condensed matter physics. You remember from 191 that energy is often a real helpful way of solving problems. And what's in chapter 6 is how to calculate the energy of the charge situation. And basically, what we're going to be dealing with increasingly is seeing that the energy is in the fields. That is to say, in the E and the D fields, as opposed to the fact that the charge is at a high voltage state. Right, so long ago, we said that the potential energy had to do with the position of the objects. And now we're trying to convince you that the potential energy has to do with the fields, the stuff that's in the vacuum between the various charged particles. But it's going to take some convincing. So the starting point for all of this is to figure out what the potential energy is of a series of point charges. So how much work would it take to assemble a particular configuration of point charges? Point charges that are at some particular set of positions. Well, we can move the first point charge in for free, right? Nothing is going to keep us from moving that any place we want. There are no forces on that guy. But when we bring the second guy up, it's going to take some energy. And we can calculate that energy, that potential energy, by taking the charge that we brought up times the voltage at that location when the particle was there. And that voltage, we know, is going to be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, the charge that was there, divided by this distance between those two particles. So originally, Q2 was at infinity, so it didn't take any, it didn't have any initial energy. In order to bring it into that particular configuration, we have to do this amount of work in order to push them together. There's that much potential energy that's being stored. Okay, so if I bring up a third charged particle, I have this energy already, but now I have some additional energy that is the charge on that guy times the voltage at that position where I brought it in. And the voltage at that position is going to be the voltage due to Q1 added to the voltage due to Q2. Okay, so I don't know if we need to bring up a fourth charge, but if we did, we would have to add the potential energy due to all the pre-existing charges. So the upshot of that is the total potential energy. What we need to do is to add up over all of the charges, and then we want to add up over all of the ones that were there before the particular one that we're talking about. So we want to add up for all j that are less than I, qi, q, it's supposed to be a qj, divided by 4 pi epsilon naught rij. Okay, so does that make sense? For every particle, we're going to add up all of the potential energy to the particles that are already there, those that are there before I. Okay, but sums like this are a little bit inconvenient, so it'd be nice to kind of convert it into a more symmetrical sort of situation. And if we think about it, this formula is symmetric in I and J, right? So if I switch around what I and J is, that's going to give me exactly the same number as it would otherwise. So currently what I'm doing, if we think about an array of I and J, so we've got all of these various 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., all of these sorts of values that we're adding over, for any particular I, we're going to sum over all of the J's that are less than that. So in particular, when I is equal to this number, these are the J's that we're going to add up. But we would get exactly the same value if we were to add up these guys. So the plan is to add up all of those and just divide by 2. Now, there isn't self-energy that's involved here, so I don't want to have an II term. So I can't kind of make it totally symmetric, but this should be the same thing as 1/2. Add up over all the I's, add up over all the J's, except I use prime to say that I'm not going to add up the special case where J equals I. And then we have this symmetrical quantity, QI, QJ, divided by 4 pi epsilon naught, and then the separation distance between those two guys. Okay? So the main upshot here was this factor of 2 that we're trying to explain and use.
This is assuming some sort of charge distribution.
Yeah, so I'm saying that we know the charge distribution, that we're trying to figure out how much energy it takes to create that particular set of charges. And we can create that set of charges in a particular order. And for every step of that order, we can calculate how much additional energy is, and this is what the total energy is. So that's the total energy of that configuration of particles. And overall plan, of course, well, there are lots of plans with conservation of energy, but one of them is we can calculate forces, of course, by taking gradients of that potential energy. Yes? No?
Yes.
So this formula, this U, is a tremendously complicated formula, right? It has in it the x, y, and z of all of the particles that are making it up. If I want to figure out what the force on the 12th particle is, I want to be taking the derivative of the 12th particle's coordinates in order to get the force on that guy. Okay, so we can figure out torques by taking gradients of the potential energy. So this is yet another way of calculating forces on particles. Okay, so let's take kind of a so this was dealing with point particles. How about if we have charge density itself? So now I'm thinking that I want to have some set, some final value of the charge distribution in space, and I'm trying to figure out what the energy is that's associated with having that charge distribution the way it is. And the way we can do this is, again, by bringing this up in little bits. So this is the final charge density. Let's bring it about by a sequence of little changes in that energy, in that charge distribution. Okay, so this is the final value. I'm going to bring the final value about by making sequential changes. And I'm not going to be particularly specific about what I'm changing at what particular time, because in the end, it's not going to matter how we assemble this charge. It's going to have some particular energy. So the little bit of energy it takes to bring up this little bit of charge, what I need to do is to integrate the little bit of added charge times the voltage where I put it. Okay, so... Say again? So phi is the voltage. And this, the dV is saying this is a volume integral. Okay, so the little bit of charge is delta rho times dV, and I'm taking that little bit of charge times the voltage at that position, and I'm adding it all up. Notice there's no 1/2 here, right? In the end, there kind of will be a 1/2 here, so you kind of want to watch the magic when that 1/2 comes about. It'll be pretty clear. Well, so there are a couple of ways we could do this. One way is to bring up this little bit of charge linearly, right? So this is going to be whatever the charge distance times some little bit of fraction. So the idea is I'm going to let lambda go from 0 to 1, and as that time, I'm going to build up uniformly all of that charge. Question? We're good? So we've shown before that everything is linear, so that if phi is the final value, the value of the voltage at any in-between time is just going to be lambda times it. Right? So the voltage depended linearly on the charges, and if the charge is currently just lambda times rho, the corresponding voltage is just going to be that. And you can see what the trick is going to be, right? I'm now going to add up the little bit of charge, which is rho d lambda, and this is going to be a sum over volume and lambda, times the voltage, which is lambda times phi dv. The integral of lambda d lambda is lambda over 2, and when I evaluate that from 0 to 1, I get 1/2. So I don't know if you like this trick or not. Oops. I sure want to use V for voltage, but phi is what we're supposed to be using. So, well, I don't know if you exactly like that or not. Here's another trickier and perhaps more useful sort of approach. Remember, Gauss's law told us that the divergence of D was equal to rho. So it has to be the case that if I take the change in d, I have to get the change in rho. So I can put in here the divergence of the little change in d that happens when I add that charge density. Okay, so if we follow this through, the little bit of change in energy I'm going to get is the divergence of the little change in d times the voltage, all of that integrated over all of space. So now we're going to do one of those tricks that we've done before. If we take the divergence of A times phi, where A is a vector and phi is a scalar, that's equal to the divergence of A times phi plus A dotted into the gradient of phi. And that's just the chain rule. So we have a term like this, and we have to rearrange things then to get the proper things in the right order. So this is then going to be the divergence of delta D times phi minus delta D times the gradient of phi. All of that with a volume integral. This guy we can convert into a surface integral, and we can put that surface integral at infinity, and we know that electric fields and voltages fall off like 1 over r, and d's fall off like 1 over r squared. So at as r goes to infinity, the surface term is going to go to 0. And we know that minus the gradient of phi is e. So what we got here then is add up the little change in d dotted into e dv. So when I change the charge density, d is going to change every place in space. So even if rho, the change in rho was confined to, say, inside a sphere, this volume, this integral is going to be over all space now, because d changed every place. So let me comment that this equation is absolutely true and useful, but we're going to be particularly interested in linear dielectrics. That is to say, where d is proportional to e. Right? In fact, if you want, d is equal to epsilon e. So what I really have here, if I actually put in the epsilon, what I've got is epsilon delta e times e. And we just kind of use the chain rule. That's delta of 1/2 e squared. Do you believe that? It's just the product rule, right? So e squared is e dot e, so the delta can act on the first e, and it can act on the second e. Add them together, I've got two of them, so I better divide by 2. Quiet, which means that you all believe this and understand this. Okay, so let's rewrite what I've got since I'm on a new transparency. So we've got delta u is the integral of 1/2 delta, and I can bring back my epsilon with my e, so I'm going to write this as d dot e integrated over all of space. So this says that the change of u is equal to the change of that. So if we just integrate up those changes, u has to be equal to 1/2 the integral of d dot e. And we really like this equation because, so let's look back at kind of the equations we've had. They've all been equally true. So this equation here emphasizes that we have potential energy because we have charge that's at high voltage. This equation here emphasizes that the energy is in the D and E fields, and all we have to do is add up that energy. So we can actually think of this as being E dot D being the energy per volume. And all we have to do is add up that energy per volume to get the total amount of energy that's stored. Okay. So, I don't know, let's work a sample problem in a second, but before we kind of quit, we've got some homework problems that are on capacitors. And, I don't know, we've talked about capacitors a few times, but there's now some sections in the book that are going to be talking about it. In the most straightforward case, like what we're talking about in 106, what we've got is a parallel plate capacitor. And in a slightly complicated version of this, we've got a dielectric that's filling this region between these parallel plates. And there are lots of other sorts of capacitors. One of the ones that we're going to have as a homework is a coaxial cable. So these are two cylinders, and the space between these is filled with some sort of dielectric. What the capacitance is, is it's the linear relationship between the charge on those plates and the corresponding voltage. Right? We know there's a linear relationship between voltage and charge. Now we're just giving the proportionality constant a name. And the setup for this is that we're going to have plus Q on this plate and minus Q on that plate so that there's no net charge to these capacitors. And so in this parallel plate capacitor, I would have Q on this inside surface, and I would have Q on the outside surface, Q minus Q on the inside surface, so there would be different surface charge densities. Okay, it's pretty easy to figure out what the voltage is in the situation. In fact, we basically did this for one of the problems that was due yesterday, due in the past. So if we make a little Gaussian surface like this, you quickly come to the conclusion that the D field any place inside this capacitor is just equal to the surface charge density. And of course, the D field is epsilon naught times the dielectric constant times E. And surface charge density is going to be charge per area. So what we've got then is the E field between these plates is the charge per area divided by epsilon naught K. And we know that the voltage difference is equal to the electric field times the difference in position. So what we're going to end up with here is that the voltage difference is equal to the separation, which I think I will call D, divided by A over epsilon naught K. That's equal to Q. So if we put that constant on the other side of the equation, we have that the capacitance is equal to epsilon naught KA divided by D. A formula that you used, I'm sure, many times in 200. Okay, so I'm assuming that this is all, if not familiar stuff, stuff that you know that you once knew. Okay, so with that, let's go back to thinking about energy, and in a real important special case, I can't remember if I assigned it as homework or not, so that you could just recopy it, but the case I have in mind is the case of a uniformly charged sphere. So I've got material here, which I've been using that for dielectric. This has a uniform charge density. Called rho, and we're interested in the potential energy of this charge distribution. So we've got radius r, we've got charge density rho, and what we're supposed to do is to find the energy. So it'd be fine with me if you thought of this as being a proton or a electron. Could be a nucleus or something like that. So we're interested in how much energy it takes to keep that charge all sitting there together. And we got two formulas, and the plan is to use both. So one formula says that we can calculate the energy by taking 1/2 the charge density times the voltage dV. That's going to be the easy way. We got another formula that says we can integrate over all space the electric field dotted into the D field, and this is all going to be in vacuum, so this D field is just going to be epsilon naught times E dV. Okay, so I don't know, we can work this problem from the get-go, and maybe we will do this other one first because the pieces will come out faster that way. So what's the electric field outside? Well, so what's the electric field generically? If I make a Gaussian surface, and I'll draw it inside, but I'm happy to think about it being outside too, what we know is that spherical symmetry tells us that the electric field is the same on every piece of that surface and that it's going out. So that the electric flux is particularly easy, it's just the electric field times the surface area of that Gaussian surface. And that has to give us the enclosed charge divided by epsilon naught. If we're outside, then the enclosed charge is just Q. Right? And if we care about it, Q is equal to the charge density times the volume of that sphere, 4/3 pi r cubed. If we're inside, then we're just going to get a fraction of that charge. And if you think about it, the charge is going to be the ratio of volumes, the ratio of volumes between the total sphere and the fraction of the sphere that we have. Right? We could work it out maybe a longer way. Are people happy with this equation? The ratio of volumes times the total is going to give us the volume here. Good for that shortcut? Okay, so outside, question? So outside, things are going to be clear, right? We're going to get the electric field is Q over 4 pi epsilon naught r squared. And inside, we're going to get, if we plug this in, you can see that we're going to get a linear proportionality because we're going to get a cancellation of all of those cubes. So we're going to get Q over 4 pi epsilon naught linearly proportional to r. And if nothing else, by units, you know you better divide that by r cubed so that it's overall Q over r squared. Notice that the formulas agree when I put in lowercase r is equal to capital R, right? They have to agree, and in fact they do. Okay, so heading for this second formula, the total energy is epsilon naught over 2, add up over all of space, it's just E squared because I pulled out the epsilon naught dV. The formula we have for E varies according to whether we're inside or outside, so we're going to want to break up the integral into inside and outside pieces. And we can use the volume element for a cylindrical shell, namely 4 pi r squared dr. Okay, so what we got there then is epsilon naught over 2. For the inside, we want to go from 0 to r, and we want to integrate this thing squared. And then we want to go from zero, from r to infinity of the other formula. And all of that needs to be multiplied by dv, which I conveniently have there. Okay, so off to work we go. So we got 2 epsilon naughts in the denominator, and we got 1 upstairs, so that's going to lead to a net, and that's true of both of them, that's going to need to lead to a net 1 epsilon naught in the denominator. We got 4 pi squared in the denominator, and we got 1 4 pi here, so that's also going to lead to a 4 pi. Everything's got a q squared in it, and we also have this 2 that's going along for the ride. So those were all the common factors. Oops, I really didn't want to do that so close. So here we have a r squared, and here we have an r squared dr, and overall, this is all over r to the sixth. And here we have from r to infinity, here we have a r squared squared, which is 1 over r to the fourth. And there we have an r squared and a dr. OK, good to go. So the antiderivative of r to the fourth is going to be r to the fifth. So this is going to give us, including this r to the sixth, it's going to give us 1 fifth of 1 over r. So the antiderivative of 1 over r, which is what we have, 1 over r squared is going to be minus 1 over r. And so when we plug in r, we're going to get 1 over r for that guy. I guess I'm happy. So of course, we can add those two things together, and we're going to get 6 over 5 r over r. And the 6 and the 2 are going to give us a 3. So we have 3 fifths of q squared divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r. Okay, so this by itself kind of looks like the voltage, because it has a Q over R times a Q, and we're kind of getting 3/5 of it. So this is the self energy that is required for a uniformly charged sphere. Okay, so we better get the same answer going the other way. So let's kind of rewrite what we know. What we know is the electric field has different formulas according to whether we're inside or out. When we're inside, what we had is Q divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r over r cubed. And when we were outside, we had Q over 4 pi epsilon naught 1 over r squared. And I write that because we want the potential energy. So it's pretty easy to get the antiderivative of these guys. So the potential energy for this is got to be, well, the antiderivative of r is going to be 1 half r squared, and it's minus the antiderivative. So this is going to give us Q over 4 pi epsilon naught 1 over r cubed, and then minus 1 half r squared, plus a constant. And that plus a constant is going to play a big role. Here, the potential energy is just going to be the one we're used to, like that. And we have to choose this constant so that the voltage is the same, whether we're just inside or just outside the boundary. So if we do all that, what we're going to have, and we might as well, just for the sake of units, let's think about that C being inside those parentheses, just because then we'll get some nicer cancellations. So if I do that, what I've got is Q over 4 pi epsilon naught 1 over r cubed, and then I've got C minus 1 half r squared wants to equal, when we evaluate it at the boundary, Q over 4 pi epsilon naught 1 over r, when we evaluate it at the boundary. Okay, so far so good. So we've got a huge number of cancellations, right? The 4 pi epsilon naughts go away. This r squared can come over there and, oops, that's an r cubed, right? Come over there as an r squared. So what we're going to have is C minus 1 half r squared wants to equal r squared. So C wants to equal 3 halves r squared. So what we've got here then for our formula for the voltage inside is going to be Q over 4 pi epsilon naught 3 halves, oops, 3 over r. I want to write that one too. So I'm going to leave one of these r's outside, and the other one I'm going to cancel out these r squareds, and then I'm going to get minus 1 half r over r squared. Okay, so if we were to graph this voltage, so it starts out being like 1 over r, and then it's going to be this kind of downward going quadratic. I'm not sure I left enough space. That is designed so that it's going to match at that location. So we've moved that downward going quadratic up until it matched what we knew had to be the case at the boundary. Okay, so now that we've got the voltage and we know the charge density is just a constant, it's pretty easy to calculate the corresponding energy, right? So the energy is going to be 1 half the charge density, which is usually inside the integral, but it's a constant so it can come outside of the integral. Then we want to add up every place there is charge, which is just from 0 to r, this voltage, which I'm not going to rewrite, and then we have the volume element, which is 4 pi r squared dr. Okay, now we wrote the other formula in terms of Q as opposed to rho, so we probably want to rewrite this rho as the total charge divided by the total volume. Okay, so if we do that, we've got a cancellation of those four pi's. This 3 can flip up. So what we've got is 3 halves q divided by r cubed. And then we've got the integral from 0 to r. And now we will fill in what that voltage is. So that voltage is this constant, q over 4 pi epsilon naught r. And then we've got 3 halves minus 1 half r divided by r squared. And all of that needs to be multiplied by r dr. Okay? If I make a mistake, tell me before I make it permanent with magic marker. Okay. We got the 4 pi epsilon naught. We got q squared. I'm going to leave the 3 halves sitting there. And I'm going to leave the r there because that was part of the other answer. I'm going to have my r cubed separate. And now I want to integrate 0 to r of 3 halves r squared minus 1 half r to the fourth divided by r squared dr. So these are all polynomials. They're pretty easy. The r squared integral is going to give us 1 third r cubed. That'll cancel that r cubed. The r to the fourth by itself without the 1 half term is going to give us a 1 fifth. R to the fifth divided by r squared is going to give us r cubed. So the r cubes are all going to nicely cancel. In terms of the constant, we have 1 third of 3 halves, which is going to give us 1 half. And then we have minus half of a fifth, which is a tenth. Okay. So a half is 5 tenths. So what we've got here is 4 tenths, which is 2 fifths. And that 2 and that 2 are nicely arranged to cancel. So we're going to end up with 3 fifths q squared divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r. Okay. So that's how we can do these sorts of energy problems. So there's a problem that I think I did not assign. I think I'm probably going to give you what the answer is, but I want to at least start to talk about it because it's crazy, but I don't know, I find it moderately interesting. So let's calculate the force between two charged particles. The hard way. So we know the answer, right? Coulomb's law. We've known it for centuries. But now we have a new and hard way to calculate this same thing. Because what we can do is we can calculate the total energy that's involved by relating this to this integral of e squared dv. Let me bring out my epsilon naught. Because we know what the electric field is every place. And then we can take the derivative with respect to this separation. Boy, is this thing going to be a mess to calculate. Right? Because the electric field due to this guy, of course, is going to be going out like that. The electric field to that guy is going to be going out like that. And we have to add up those electric fields to get the net electric field and then square it. So not a rational way to apply Coulomb's law, but a fun and interesting way to do interesting new integrals. It's not quite as bad as I've suggested, because we know that this electric field is the sum of two parts. We're going to have E1 added to E2 squared. And what squared means is dot product with itself. So this is going to give us E1 squared plus E2 squared plus twice the dot product of E1 and E2. And now's the thing that an unfortunate fact that we have to face, and it's one of the reasons for doing this problem. Let's think about just doing this piece by itself, because it's pretty easy, right? So this is going to be the integral of q divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r squared squared, and we can do this spherically symmetrical around that point. So the volume is going to be 4 pi r squared dr, and we want to integrate this over all space. So we can throw aside the constants because they're not going to be play a big role. So this is the integral from 0 to infinity of basically 1 over r squared dr, and that has an antiderivative that is 1 over r. And while infinity doesn't cause us any problem, 0 causes us mutual problems. And in retrospect, this kind of makes sense. There's an infinite amount of energy to push all of that charge into a point spot. And that's what this is telling us. There's an infinite self-energy to this point charge. So there really aren't point charges, right? Everything really is a ball of charge. So if we really wanted to model this correctly, if we wanted those point charges to be electrons or protons, the charge is really distributed through some volume. And we've just done the calculation for what e squared integrated over all space is here. It's not infinite, right? As soon as I make that, as soon as I spread that point charge over some finite volume, then I don't have that infinity. Okay, so does that throw off all our plans? Because as long as I consider those things point charges, I'm going to get infinity. And the problem was hard enough dealing with them as point charges. I really don't want to spread these out over some radius r, if I can at all avoid it. Particularly since for protons, that radius is effectively pretty small, about 10 to the minus 15th meters. And the answer is, we don't really care about these integrals. Because these integrals, whatever they are, infinite as they are, they don't depend on that distance. They're constants. And even when you take the derivative of an infinite constant, it's still zero. Have I sold that? I can sell changes in infinity that are zero. I don't know. You'll believe anything I say is often what students say. A wise choice, I'm sure. Okay, so that's the claim that, in fact, all I need to do is to calculate that dot product. But that, of course, isn't looking all that friendly either, right? Because it's kind of a mess. But let's at least rewrite it. And then I think what I'll do is I'll write it out. Hard copy, it's a lot of steps to do that integral. And a lot of kind of moderately interesting math. But it does actually work in the end. So what we really think now is the potential energy is some infinite constant, which is due to the self-energy of those point charges. And we don't worry too much about that because, A, they're not really point charges. They're just very small charges. And they have some self-energy, which is finite. And if we take the change in that finite self-energy, it's going to give us zero for the change. So what we have to add up then, that what will depend on this position is that dot product. So what we're going to have then is an integral. The 2 is going to divide out because of that. What we want to do is to take the dot product of E1 and E2 and integrate that over all space. Okay, so that's a project that's a take-home project. And what I promise you is, in the end, when we take the derivative of all of this, we will get what we knew to start with, that this force was going to be q1, q2 divided by 4 pi epsilon naught, the distance between them squared. It's just a very hard way of calculating that force. What more do I want to talk about? I This is mostly all that I cared about. Well, we could do some more 105. Oh, we probably need to do some more 105, 106 sort of level stuff about capacitors. So back to 200, 106 sort of stuff. So we said that parallel plate capacitors, capacitance is by definition the proportionality constant between the charge that's stored on one of these plates and the corresponding voltage difference between these two plates. If we have a parallel circuit, something like that, I hope it's clear that these guys have the same voltage, but the total charge that's stored is just the sum of those charges. So the total charge, Q1 plus Q2, is just going to be the capacitance of one times the shared voltage plus the capacitance of the other one times the shared voltage. So it is as if there were a capacitor, a so-called equivalent capacitor, that had capacitance that's simply the sum. If we have the series circuit of capacitors, the important thing to recognize is that this piece of conductor is totally isolated. So that if I declare that there is minus Q charge on this conductor, there has to be plus charge on that one, right? It's not connected to anything else. So in this situation, all of them have the same, effectively the same charge in this sequence. There's going to be some voltage drop across this guy and some voltage drop across this one, but the total voltage drop is just the sum of the voltage drops across the two. And the voltage drop across V1 we could calculate by just taking the charge divided by the capacitance. The other one has the same charge. And in the final step, if we move all of that to the other side of the equation, we see that the effective capacitance of a series circuit, they add an inverse. Okay, so this is all stuff that I know you once knew and maybe even knew recently. We know that the energy that's stored is 1/2 the charge times the voltage. So we have that formula for the energy stored on a capacitor. And we can write that lots of different ways, right? We could plug in that the charge is equal to Q times V. So this is going to be 1/2 CV squared. We could write that the voltage is the charge divided by the capacitance. So this could be Q squared over C. Okay. So let's calculate the capacitance of our parallel capacitor the hard way, right? By looking at how much energy is stored in the electric and the electric fields that are between the plates. So here I have parallel plate capacitor, and we are going to work this with dielectric in here. And I'm going to put we can proceed either way. So we can I'm going to put some charge on this capacitor plate, and of course minus charge here. And I'm going to calculate the total energy, and then since that has to equal Q squared over C, we'll be able to calculate what C is. Okay, so the energy that we're going to calculate is, of course, 1/2 the integral over all space of E dot D dV. And the first approximation that we're going to make is that everything is zero outside. Right? Technically, it's only true for infinite parallel plate capacitors. Real parallel plate capacitors, as you've seen by direct calculation, they have a little bit of so-called fringing electric field on the outside, which we'll ignore. It actually doesn't take that much work to calculate the correction term because of that fringing field. So I now give you a challenge problem. If we compare the ideal capacitor, you know, and for the ideal capacitor, the capacitance is epsilon naught Ka divided by D. If we compare the ideal capacitor to the real capacitor that has fringing fields, which one has a bigger capacitance? The real one or the ideal one? That's a question you can fool PhD physicists on because they think they know the answer. Okay, so what is the D field in the approximation that the electric field is zero outside? You all know that that if we make a little Gaussian surface that has one surface that's inside the conductor where D is equal to zero, the Gaussian surface only is going to have a contribution from this plate here. The D field in this case is going to go down, so D dot N is going to be plus D times the area. The enclosed charge is going to be the surface charge times the area. So this D just ends up being sigma. E, of course, is just equal to D divided by epsilon naught K. And these are all constants. We can pull them outside of the integral. So what we're left with is the total volume, and the total volume is the area times the displacement. Okay, so it's right what we've got. We've got U is equal to 1/2 the electric field, which was D, which was sigma, times D times the volume, which was the area times the displacement. These guys are both Q divided by area. So if I plug and chug them through, I've got my 1/2, I've got a Q squared, I've got a partial cancellation of that area. I got one left in the denominator, and I've got D. And lo and behold, what we've got in the denominator is exactly what we knew we needed to get. Okay, so I think you have a homework problem that is similar but has a sequence of dielectrics in between it. Okay, questions? I think I'm going to call it quits. We've got the dull stuff about capacitors. What's next is to start figuring. So let me kind of introduce this a little bit, because it's maybe slightly surprising. So what happens if I've got a dielectric that is half in and half out? And incidentally, the standard way of actually doing this experiment is to think about a glass of something like water and put your parallel plate capacitors here. And the question is, what is, when I start to charge up this capacitor, what's going to be the force on this dielectric? Is it going to be pulled in or pushed out? What's going to happen? Well, let me convince you that that it's going to be pushed out, which is wrong, but I think I can convince you of it, and that's a problem, right? What we'll do next time is I will write a formula for the force, and one time I will write plus the derivative, and the other time I will write minus the derivative, and it's exactly the same thing I'm taking the derivative of. That should worry you, right? Because the force can't be both plus and minus the same thing. I mean, it's got to be something. So it's so if you had said the reverse, I could have tried to convince you that it's going to be sucked in. And maybe I'll get my numbers backwards. So what we know is that the energy in this capacitor is 1/2 C times V squared. And we know that this capacitance depends on the dielectric constant. The more dielectric constant that's inside this capacitor, the larger the capacitance and the more the energy. And things don't go to larger energy, they go to less energy. Right? I think those are all more or less true statements. So this dielectric should go to smaller energy, which would mean that it should be pushed out so that the so that we're going downhill. So I repeat, that's false. I have lied to you somehow. But it should have been a totally convincing argument, because I think all of the pieces I said were true. If this thing goes in, the energy goes up. And things don't, you know, when I drop this pencil, it doesn't go to higher potential energy. It goes to lower potential energy. So let me give you at least a hint about, you know, what crazy thing had gone on. What if I had decided to write the formula the other way? Now larger C goes downhill. This formula is right. This formula is right. One of them seems to be saying that it goes this way. One of them seems to be saying that it goes that way. And of course, the answer isn't that it goes both ways, right? It does always get sucked in. So that's the setup for next time. Are you sufficiently boggled? I hear the sound of quiet, which is...
Why can you say that E and Q don't depend on where the dielectric is?
Well, they don't, typically. Mm-hmm. Right, so if you got a capacitor, where's the charge going to go? Mm-hmm. There's no place to go. But I don't disagree with your complaint. Do I hear the sound of dissatisfied students who want their Christmas present opened early? So first of all, notice I answered his question for the case that was right, right? Right? This gave me the right answer. Yeah. And I said, of course the charge is constant. In order to have the voltage constant, I have to have this connected to a battery. And the battery is going to be doing work that we haven't included. The charge is going to change on the capacitor then. And the battery is going to be doing work. The net flow is going to be downhill, but the capacitor by itself went uphill.
So if it was like an unconnected capacitor, then it just had charge, then it would suck.
So the unconnected capacitor gives us the right answer.
Yeah.
And a connected capacitor can't act differently from a disconnected capacitor. So the reason the connected capacitor seems to be giving us the wrong answer is because we haven't given it the total potential energy. We've only included the potential energy here. We haven't included the potential energy of the battery. And it turns out that it's going to do twice as much negative work as is here. And so it's going to exactly cancel the positive potential energy change that's happening here. And we're still going to get a negative potential energy when this thing goes in. I still hear the sound of quiet, which is not my favorite sound. You do have the options 1 through 4, right? I guess I should mention also in that regard, I think only one person has done their detailed question.